Okay, this is a meeting of the Due Process Oversight Committee of the IFRS, of the Board of Trustees of the IFRS Foundation, being held on October 13th. It is open to the public and it is being recorded. We will start with an update on technical activities. Henry, I'm going to turn that over to you. I think it's at the beginning. This is there are times when the committee is asked to reach conclusions and take decisions. This meeting with respect to technical activities is not one of those meetings. There are no decisions that are required by the DPOC at this meeting, but it is part of our overall update so that we know what is going on in the technical area. Henry, it's all yours.
Thank you, Alan. So this is agenda reference 1B. It's the report of the technical activities of the board and the interpretations committee for the last 4 months, and as Alan said, it has no specific ask of you today, but it is intended to keep you appraised of the technical work of the board and the interpretations committee. Given where we are with most of our projects, I'm really going to take this largely as read, but just highlight one or two things in the paper. Firstly, on page 3, we've listed the new standards, amendments issued in the period, and really what I just wanted to flag for confirmation as much as anything is that the board completed two important and time-critical projects in the period that we've covered extensively in these meetings over the last couple of years. First is the IFRS 17 amendments that were issued very soon after our previous meeting. And the second are the IBOR reform amendments. Now, as you can see on page 6 of the memo from page 10, the board completed the redeliberations of the exposure draft very smoothly, very expeditiously in June and July. And the amendments, and these amendments complete the board's response to the market reforms of IBOR benchmark rates, were issued in August, so well in time to be available for the marketplace. Now, turning to page 8 and paragraph 26, we reported extensively at the last meeting on the board's response to the coronavirus pandemic. And just to update you on things, we've continued to be very actively monitoring application of the standards in the period and continuing with the dialogue with the regulators, the accounting firms, and the national standard setters. Might also note, actually, I think we held a really valuable and important panel discussion at our recent virtual conference covering sort of application of the standards, including in the sort of the stressed environment that we're in at the moment. Now, as the paper notes, we've not identified any further standard setting or need for educational materials at this stage, but of course we continue to, as I say, actively monitor the position. And we also reported last time on the adjustments that we made to the timelines of various of the projects in the light of the pandemic. And we continue to monitor carefully our stakeholders' capacity to provide the critical high quality input that we need into some important consultation documents that we have out or and will be issuing over the next few months. And although we believe that we're able to meet the revised timelines that are set out in this memo and reflect the work plan as it currently is, we do understand that some stakeholders are just struggling given COVID-19 and the volume of consultation documents that we have planned over the next few months. Clearly, obviously, some of our stakeholders have had to furlough staff or their financial reporting people are tied up with addressing present reporting challenges rather than responding to our consultation documents. So we're very much continuing to really monitor these developments and consider the implications for the work plan. Also on page 8, starting at paragraph 28, I just wanted to give you a brief report really on the primary financial statements project. This has perhaps dropped off recent agendas, but as you know, the board issued the major exposure draft for this project last December, and the comment letter period, which was extended, so it was originally 6 months, it got extended by another 3 months, has just ended. And it was simply to give you a sense of the extensive activities that have been going on outreach on this project over the last 6 to 9 months. And of course, almost all of these activities have been undertaken virtually, everything since March. Now, the feedback from these various meetings that we've held and also the field work that we've been doing will complement the, I think it's just over 200 comment letters that we have received on the project. And so the team now is working to analyze all the feedback we've received, and we'll bring it all back to the board to start the re-deliberations at the end of the year. So that's one we'll be picking up in future meetings and keeping you appraised. And then lastly, the project I just wanted to mention was on page 9, paragraph 37, the management commentary practice statement. We're continuing to make good progress on this project, and the substantive discussions are now largely complete. I think the point I just wanted to flag this afternoon was the board has been working on the basis that the consultation document that it plans to publish next year will be an exposure draft, but later this month the board is going to be asked to confirm actually that the next consultation document will be an exposure draft and that the discussion paper is not necessary. And I think that the staff paper will be arguing and noting that what the board has developed is a set of proposals that are sufficiently well developed and detailed to progress to an exposure draft. And of course, there's good support for the overall direction of this project. So, Alan, those were the comments I just wanted to make in respect to this paper, but obviously committee members may have comments or questions, so I'll pause there.
Of course. Thank you, Henry. Does anyone on the committee have any comments or questions? Okay. I have a comment and a question about the IFRIC pieces of the report, Henry. The comment is simply, if you go back to paragraph, this is just a kind of informational, if you go back to paragraph 7 of the paper, which is a list of the agenda consultations that have recently been put out, those were, just for clarity, those were all adopted prior to the adoption of the changes to the due process handbook, and so those agenda decisions were adopted under the prior procedures, which in particular do not include the formal submission to the board and the determination of whether there are not objections from a whatever number of board members it is that would cause the decision not to be published. The newer anything from here on in, of course, will follow those new procedures. The question I had, Henry, was about the two submissions in September to the IFRIC, and just wondered, could either of them be described as COVID-19 related, or are they? Do they come from other sources or stimulus or whatever?
Alan, I don't believe that they were.
That they were COVID related.
No, that they. Sorry, I don't believe that they were COVID related. That's right, not.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Are you still there, Alan?
I'm sorry, I was muted through all of that. I'll do it quickly. If we've done the connect technical activities, there are three items on the agenda: consultative groups, annual report protocol, and education materials, which are reports that are provided to this committee by the staff on an annual basis. Bringing this to the committee is required by the handbook, and so this is part of our formal work plan and work program. We're going to take them in order. We'll start with consultative groups, and Henry, I will ask you again to present.
Yes, thank you, Alan. So this is paper 1C. So this is the annual report looking at the Foundation's seven standing consultative groups and three project-specific groups. And just so you're aware, and I think it's important context, I presented a draft of this report to the board at their administration meeting in September. Now, to support the review, the tables on pages 5 to 7 summarize the activities of each group. I think it's worth highlighting really that the number of meetings in the period has not really been significantly affected by the pandemic, though of course obviously since March we have been making much more use in the past of video conference technology. We did cancel the July ASAP meeting, as we previously explained, and we also postponed the joint GPF Global Preparers Forum and the CMAC, Capital Markets Advisory Committee, in July, and been postponed to later this year. But given where we are with many of the projects, this has not had an adverse impact on gathering input. I've also noted that there are a couple of project groups. This is the consultative groups for rate regulation and management commentary, where we will be looking at the role and membership of the group members after we publish the respective consultation documents next year before we move to the next phases of these projects. And so that will be something we will update you on at future meetings. And we also have continued to consider the question about, you know, are there more objective ways of our assessing our engagement with these groups and the effectiveness of our engagement? As noted in the paper, we did have a broad discussion with the Advisory Council in May on the topic of KPIs. And this is an area where we're still thinking and reflecting on that feedback, and it's an area that we continue to work on. So turning to paragraph 7, you'll see that overall we've assessed that the groups are continuing to serve the function for which they were established, and we also believe the board has received useful input from all of the groups that met in the period. There's no formal action required of the committee, but obviously appreciate any comments or questions you might have on this review. Thank you.
Any comments or questions from committee members?
Alain, it's Michel here. Just maybe two comment and question. One was the advisory council is not listed in this review, unless I'm mistaken. Is that something? Is it because of its specific status, or is there any reason why not? And the second is in terms of KPI, and I know this is something we've been talking about previously, but any kind of time horizon you can see in terms of coming up with a more formal sort of or structured assessment of the contribution of these groups? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Michelle. In terms of the assessment of the Advisory Council, I think that's a separate matter, and with the council being part of one of the constitutional bodies like the IFRS Interpretations Committee, that sort of gets picked up, via other means rather than through this committee. In terms of your question around the KPIs, very much note your point about that. And, I think that's something that we really do hope to make some more progress on over this year, basically.
Right.
Just to add to that, I think we've made good progress on the quantitative measures. The table you have describes much better the frequency of meeting, the number of people that attend, and how many, in effect, don't attend. It's the qualitative stuff which is much more difficult, not least when we're running these meetings remotely like this, trying to assess the quality of the advice we're given and the way that it's provided. We are working on it. It's not there yet, I'm afraid, Michel.
Right. It's Alain. Let me, on Michelle's questions and comments, which I think are very well taken and important. The board, the advisory council is, as Henry notes, created not through the consultative group process, but as a creature of our constitution. The trustees as a whole have responsibility for thinking about the advisory council. You will recall in connection with the handbook that we have modified the Constitution, and that was a trustee activity, although albeit at this committee's recommendation because of our work on the handbook, to make the focus more strategic and less technical and have them looking more to advise the trustees rather than to advise the board on technical activities, in part given the fact that there are consultative groups that that provide some of that technical feedback. But you'll also recall that we had a presentation by the new head of the council at one of our recent trustee meetings, and I think the future population and function of that council will continue to be something that the board, the trustees as a whole, rather than this committee, will be paying attention to. Two other thoughts from my point of view, Henry. One on and Richard. One on KPIs. I can only I second Michelle's question. We've had this conversation. It would be great to make some more formal progress on the qualitative side. I certainly appreciate how that's much more difficult than the quantitative side. I think we've made progress. I think this committee is now much better informed as to the metrics of the way these groups are functioning, but not necessarily the qualitative metrics. And I guess I had one thought on that, at least for you guys to take back and think about, which is, the paper notes, commenced a practice, I gather, at the staff level of going back to the groups themselves and asking them for evaluation of the qualitative or the quality of the work that they're doing, how it might improve, how the meetings might improve, and so forth. And I think that's an important step in the right direction. It seems to me that because the ultimate purpose of the review is, well, back a step. The ultimate purpose of these consultative groups is to provide assistance to the board. And evaluation of their success, I think, has to depend ultimately on a determination that they are providing some level of assistance to the board. Some of the standing ones, I think it's quite clear that, that they have and they will continue to do so. But nonetheless, that's the key metric here. And I'm wondering, I know the staff tries to reach some conclusions about that, and that's indeed the key, that's indeed the basis for the staff's conclusion that these groups are functioning, and I don't quarrel with that. I think impressionistically it's correct. But should we have a more formal process as part of this evaluation, not at the committee level, but in terms of the staff in preparing the review, should the staff have a more formal process for consulting with at least certain members of the board as to these groups' performance, in addition to a formal process of kind of consulting with the groups themselves? Sorry for the long-winded nature of the question, but the real...
Yeah, it's Alex. Alex is here. Can you hear me, Alex?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Alex.
Just a comment here, because I'm a former member of the advisory council.
Could someone speak up a little bit? I'm having trouble hearing.
Just better now? Better now? You hear me better?
Better now. Thank you.
Okay. Now, just a comment here on because I'm a former member of the advisory council, and I understand that is not the role of the DPOC to make a complete review of the advisory council function, but I think it's worth, and I think it's well deserved, to make this evaluation, because at least for my, or at least to propose that the whole group of the trustees to get involved on that evaluation, because I personally think that the role of an advisory council on a practical matter is not really well defined. Okay, so I'm a bit skeptical about the actual contribution and the way it is organized. So, and I think this is maybe we should not define it here or conduct it here, but I think it's a good evaluation of that group is well deserved. I'm a little bit skeptical of the strategic contribution. Okay? Maybe it's my skepticism, it's personal, but as a former member, I'm a bit skeptical of the way it works.
Right.
So, Alex, are you suggesting that as a role for the Due Process Oversight Committee, in addition to the work that the full trustees is doing on the Advisory Council?
Yes, I think they have a role on the due process activity. I would say so. They have a role, you know? And I from time to time have this discussion about it is more strategic, it is less strategic, how to measure, how to evaluate the impact. And my personal view is that this deserves to be done. You know? We should get a little bit deeper on that.
I don't think the issue here is whether there's a recognition that further thinking about the composition and role of the advisory council worth doing. I mean, I guess I thought from the activities of the last few trustees meetings, the report we had from the head of the advisory council, and the fact that he's working very hard on sort of thinking about composition and role. I think it's fair to take as a given that the concerns you're raising are valid concerns, at least for consideration. I think the issue, as Sue, I think it was Sue, it's hard to tell sometimes in this telephonic environment, as Sue was raising, is whether that the right place to do that is the DPOC. And I think the conclusion, at least so far, has been there's certainly nothing in the Constitution that gives us that mandate. There's certainly nothing in the handbook that gives us that mandate. And I think, frankly, given the way the council, given the way the advisory council is established in our organization, this really is one for the trustees as a whole to take on. If they wanted to hand it off to us or somebody else, that would be okay. But in a sense, this is at least constitutionally and substantively important enough that it's not that your concerns are not absolutely valid. It's that the right forum for them, I think, is the trustees.
I personally, I agree with that, Alan, but I think that maybe we should put this issue on the table, okay? So raise this issue,
okay.
Because I think they are important, okay?
We can think about a way to do that. I can certainly, I will be summarizing this meeting for the trustees as a whole on Thursday, I guess. I do not mind bringing that up.
Yeah, I don't know if your others agree, but it's at least my personal view.
Other thoughts on this?
I mean, Alan, my only thought would be that, you know, since there is an ongoing process, maybe we should let it run its course, and I think Alexander should really contribute to that, and as others.
Yeah, well, I would certainly, that's correct, and it would not be my proposal that this committee do anything without the trustees asking us to do so, and I would be surprised if the trustees wanted that to happen while, as you say, this process is going on. So this will not be a call to arms, but I don't mind. In fact, it's incumbent on me since it was brought up at the committee, kind of incumbent on me to let the full trustees know what we are talking about. So I will do that.
Alan, it's Teresa here. If I may just add, following up the comment just made about the role of the advisory council in relation to these matters. And it may well be appropriate, given that we have a new chair, to ask for their input as to how they can make this process more beneficial from both sides. So, but I agree that we shouldn't interrupt this particular process in relation to the documents which are being done. But I think it's a separate exercise. It wouldn't hurt to, in view of the comments that have been made, to find out how any input from the advisory council, if we wish to continue to that process, can make the process more beneficial and which will result in them feeling that they can make a real contribution to the process.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. Yes, it does. We can think about how to try to do that.
Alan, sorry, can I also just revert back to your first comment as well? I certainly think that's something that we should definitely explore about there's some way, you know, without making this an overly bureaucratic or cumbersome process, but just finding some way to to get more of a sense of board members' input on the advice that they're getting would be something that we can certainly explore and build into this.
I'm not looking for more bureaucracy, but I do think, especially if we're trying to, if we're trying to come up with indicators, I would have thought that directly, as they're trying to measure in some sense board satisfaction with these various groups' activities, is it's kind of the critical KPI here. Okay, have we exhausted this subject? Anything else? Okay, Henry, I'll turn to you again on the annual report protocols.
Thank you. Yeah, so this is now paper 1D, and this paper just recaps various matters which we report to you on an annual basis, so the receipt of comment letters and their public availability, the availability of papers to observers, and then also a summary of the board's dialogue with the securities and other regulators. And there's no formal ask of you of this paper. I think there's just a couple of comments I wanted to make. First of all, in terms of comment letters, you'll see in paragraph 9 that we've recently made improvements to the website to ensure that a stakeholder that fails to successfully submit a comment letter, and that's most commonly because their letter is not in the format specified on the submissions page on the website, just to make sure that they now receive an explicit warning that they've not been successful in submitting their comment letter. And as you can see, this should address a problem that we recently identified, although we think that the risk that more than a handful of letters were affected in this way or would have affected re-deliberations is extremely low. And the other comment I wanted to make refers to the last section of the paper, starting at paragraph 13. And this is about the interaction, the engagement with the securities and the regulators. And I wanted to really highlight that, of course, the usual formal meetings that we've had with the securities and the prudential regulators have continued this year. But I think it is worth highlighting that overall, there has probably been more dialogue with the regulators this year as we have tried to, you know, make use of those relationships that we have to keep close to them through the pandemic. And, you know, we would think that this has been beneficial both to ensure that we've had the opportunity to comment on important draft statements that the regulators may have been considering publishing, and so we've been able to see them in advance of publication, but also just to make sure that the, you know, we've been putting out messages around IFRS 9, for example, as you know, and just to ensure that there's a consistency in the messaging, there's not sort of a conflict created in the marketplace. And so our assessment is that dialogue has been good and has been very much a positive development. As I say, there's no formal action, so are there any questions on this paper?
Alan, I had a question in relation to the UK and the prospect.
Go ahead.
Situation. How much engagement has been between the new authorities that are being set up in the UK and your teams, and what to expect forward, and how is that going to change the dialogue with Europe?
Michelle, you were asking about the relationship with the UK bodies.
Right, and I understand this new appointment and new organisation being set up by the UK in light of,
yes. I could talk briefly about that if you like, Henry. It's Sue.
Okay, Sue, thank you.
Please, yeah, go ahead.
So on the prudential regulatory side, we have a lot of dialogue with obviously the Prudential Regulatory Authority and the Bank of England, and that's ongoing. On the accounting standard setting side of things, there's a couple of things going on. One is that Lee and his team have got dialogue ongoing with BEIS, so the government authorities who are responsible for setting up the new endorsement body. In addition to that, our UK board member, Nick Anderson, is responsible for the sort of liaison role, if you like, with the FRC. And so he has been meeting them regularly and keeping abreast of the changes there, and also meeting with Pauline Wallace, who's a new lead of the new UK endorsement body. So we are, in effect, establishing, you know, continued and sort of deeper dialogue, if you like, with the new UK endorsement body, continuing the relationship we had with the FRC, in addition to and sort of in parallel to our ongoing relationship with the European Commission and EFRAG. So we're sort of trying to make sure that we're covering both tracks of dialogue.
So effectively, is there at the end of the year there would be a substitution between in terms of representation from the UK by this body that would work?
Sorry, I can't hear you.
I was asking if at the end of this year there would be some form of substitution between the UK new bodies and the European bodies that were in place up to now, or UK matters, obviously?
For UK matters, it will be the UK endorsement body who will be the ones who will be responsible for undertaking the sort of equivalent role that EFRAG plays in Europe for endorsement. And so that's the body that we are working with. And we're also talking to BEIS to make sure that we've got the appropriate link with our Accounting Standards Advisory Forum. The FRC has held the seat, and we're just confirming the arrangements going forward with our BEIS. So if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Now, okay. Alan, if I may.
Sure.
So just a general question following up Michelle's. Our relationship with regulatory bodies, is it in a place where we feel it's in a good position, or are there we're not necessarily getting into any country specific situation? Are there areas that where there's important room for improvement?
I can start, Henry, and then do you want to add on? So I think that I would say that we've got very good engagement with both prudential and securities regulators. I think that the situation we've seen in the COVID environment has shown us the strength of the relationships we've got there. I think in particular we've got good relationships with the Basel Committee and the Basel Accounting Expert Group, in addition to the ECB and the PRA in the UK. In the securities regulation space, we've got very good relationship with IOSCO, particularly with Committee 1, who looks after accounting matters, and there's regular meetings and dialogues with them. And there's a very good relationship with ESMA, the European securities regulators. I think that's all good. I think there's good lines of communication, quite open communication in both directions. I think the other good thing that we have seen as well during the COVID situation is that there's been a couple of situations where particular national regulators have reached out to us to talk about particular matters that have arisen in relation to COVID. So, for example, we had some discussions with the Australian regulator about the leasing standard in the context of COVID. So I think the work that we've put in over the last few years to sort of deepen these relationships is coming to fruition. So I think that those relationships are working well. I think having said all of that, what's really important for us in terms of consistent application in particular is that global networks such as IOSCO themselves are sort of effective in helping with that coordination role, given that they're a central touch point for us. And so that's important to our success indirectly.
I agree. Thank you, Sue.
Okay. Anything else on this subject? Okay. We're going to move to our last report. Henry, do you want to lead us through educational material? I would only note one thing on this, which is this year's educational material report, as you will recall, the DUHOT process handbook was amended to clarify the level of review that's required for various types of educational material, and the structure that we put in place in the handbook is used in this review that Henry's going to be presenting to us.
Yes, thank you, Alan. So this is 1E, and certainly actually putting this paper together this year has been a lot easier in the last couple of years, where I've had to explain how we've interpreted the requirements of the former due process handbook to apply to the type of materials that we're now presenting. So that's why this paper is significantly shorter than it was, say, last year. I really have very little to note on this paper, but just what it does is it highlights the educational material that's been published on our website in the last year to support application of the standards. So it's dealing with educational material about IFRS standards, not materials that the project teams might put out to explain an exposure draft, for example. And the materials have been listed in the appendix, classified according to the improved categorization that is now specified by the due process handbook, showing the review that each of the materials has received from the one board member level through to the three board member levels. Maybe on that three board level list on page three, just worth highlighting those two educational documents that we explained at the last meeting that we'd produced in the early months of the pandemic. So important bits of education material about applying IFRS 9, the new expected credit loss model, and also IFRS 16 and dealing with rent concessions. So on that basis, I can confirm that all of the education material that's been published in the year has received the level of review as required by the revised due process handbook. And Alan, that's all I wanted to say about this paper. Thank you.
Okay. Henry, thank you. The paper does ask the committee basically to, the way I would describe it is, on the basis of what we've heard from the staff and from Henry and what's contained in the report, without carrying out anything resembling a de novo or substantive review of the materials, are we comfortable that the handbook procedures have been followed? My own view, based on what Henry has told us and what the report shows and the work we did on the handbook, is that that has been accomplished. If anyone on the committee, again, in this kind of environment, I will do this by negative assurance. Are there any comments by the committee that would suggest a different conclusion? Okay, I will take that as an answer to that question. I would make one very quick observation.
Please hold.
Are we still on?
Yes, Alan.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Okay. one very quick observation. Obviously, in a remote environment, it's a little difficult to tell what everybody, it's a little bit more difficult to tell what everybody is doing all of the time, and that might extend to what educational material is being contemplated and published. I think we have pretty robust procedures in place to do that, but I would note for Henry and the staff that keeping an eye on what goes out the door virtually in the context of the requirements of this section of the handbook is probably a little bit more challenging in this environment, and I would urge you to pay sort of a little bit of extra attention to that. The next thing I have, and I want to do this all very quickly, but we've published the due process handbook. I think it's been well received based on everything I've heard and the press reports and so forth. But Sam, do you want to give us a minute or two on that?
Yes, of course, Alan. Thank you very much. So there's no paper associated here. We just, as Alan said, just very briefly wanted to provide an oral update, as this is the first meeting of the DPAC since we published the handbook in back in August, and just wanted to acknowledge a couple of post-publication points. Firstly, there have been some very good publications produced by some of the major accounting firms, which do explain the changes made to the handbook, notably relating to agenda decisions. I'll happily distribute those among the DPAC members because I just think they're useful to have for information. Also worth noting that those publications have indeed clearly utilised some of the information that we provided in the feedback statement that we have published alongside the handbook, which essentially demonstrates the importance of producing such thorough comms documents alongside the publication of the main document. Other than that, and the second point I wanted to raise is that Henry is also leading the efforts of communicating and explaining the changes made in the handbook to the technical staff and educating them on how those changes may affect their work on technical projects, which of course, Henry, feel free to add anything further or more specific if you wish. But Alan, yeah, just very briefly, that was everything I wanted to highlight regarding post-publication of the handbook. So thank you very much.
Terrific. Thank you, Sam. Anything, comments, questions, anything to add on this? Okay, hearing none. Richard, our last piece of formal business. I know as of a couple of days ago, we had not received any correspondence that this committee had to pay attention to, but I'll ask you to update that for us. Is there anything that we've received that we need to be paying attention to in terms of correspondence?
And then I can confirm nothing has been received.
Excellent. Thank you. At this point, I would close the public meeting. We will have a very brief private session to just sort of recap a couple of things, and then that will call it a day. But Jenny, can you?
Alan, I feel that we can't allow the meeting to close without recording that, unless anything happens, this would be your last meeting as chair. Just to record how much I and I'm sure my colleagues have enjoyed working with you during these last few years. It's been a great pleasure.
You're very kind. I was actually going to say something later. I'll say it now. This is, in the absence of something unexpected, my last meeting as chair of the DPOC. And what I want to say, and it is not about me, is I want to thank the members of the committee and the members of the staff for the dedication and the hard work supporting the work of this committee. And this committee is an important piece of the overall IFRS structure, due process, openness, transparency, accountability, in one sense, all land here, and the dedication of everybody on the phone to this has been great throughout my tenure, and so I would like to thank you for that. And with that, Jenny, we can wrap it up if you wish.
Yep.